Today, could the secret files of a world-famous crime writer help to solve one of Europe's most high-profile murders? And on Valentine's Day, we chat to the first same-sex couple to get married in Northern Ireland.
So it's a typical March day in Stockholm, snowy, dark, and I've just arrived with my old square Volvo outside this rented storage facility. And I'm waiting for my man, Daniel Pohl, the editor-in-chief of the Expo magazine. He comes with his small, tiny Japanese car, pulls up next to me, and we go to open up the doors. And it almost feels cozy when we enter there, despite the fact that it's just a sheet metal building. We walk the long corridors, we arrive to a special storage space, and Daniel pulls up this sheet metal door, and I suddenly see 20 cardboard boxes full of documents, and the right labels are there. It's about the Palma murder, and it says the Stieg Larsson files.
Jan Stocklasser is describing stumbling upon a huge archive of files compiled by one of the most famous crime novelists in the world, Stieg Larsson. The paperwork revealed that the author of the best-selling Girl with the Dragon Tattoo had spent much of his adult life obsessing over a real crime. One of Europe's most famous unsolved mysteries, the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme in 1986. The documents showed how the novelist had been diligently piecing together clues to the murder before his untimely death in 2004. A decade later, Stocklasser, a former Swedish diplomat, picked up Larsson's trail, and with it, an obsession that has led him to new evidence now being investigated by Swedish police, who remain desperate to track down the killer. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, who killed Olof Palme? The unsolved murder that still haunts Sweden.
On the 28th of February in 1986, our Prime Minister Olof Palme and his wife Lisbeth Palme had planned to go to the cinema. They left their home around 8 o'clock in the evening. They took the normal underground, and they had called off their bodyguards. Sometimes our prime minister wanted to feel like a normal person. They're going to see the movie The Brother Mozart, which was a very popular film at the moment. It's about a crazy theater director who's trying to run this theater piece about Mozart. And he's fighting against the whole ensemble, and it just becomes a crazy comedy. After the movie ended, our prime minister and his wife started walking towards their home in the old town of Stockholm.
Do you know what the weather was like?
It was -7 degrees centigrade, and was still snowing a bit, and quite a chilly wind, so it felt like -15. So not a nice evening to be out on. But it was Friday night, so there were quite a lot of people actually moving around anyway. They started walking along Sveavägen. Lisbeth wanted to look in a shop window, so they crossed the street. A couple of hundred meters later, they came to the corner of the building. There was a man waiting for them. And he stepped up from behind, and he shot one shot in the back of our prime minister, who fell to the ground. Lisbeth was dragged together with him to the ground. The man fired another shot, went through her coat, and made a scratch on her bare back.
Was Olof Palme killed instantly?
Olof Palme died immediately. Before he reached the ground, he was dead.
How did the killer escape?
So soon after the killer has shot the two shots, he starts running into an alley off the street, the busy street, and he runs for two blocks before he reaches stairs with 89 steps, and he starts running up those stairs to escape.
Did anyone see him?
At the murder scene, there were 15 witnesses that saw part or whole of the shooting. So after the murderer runs up the stairs and bumps into two witnesses and runs into a side street, after that he vanishes. And after that we know hardly anything. So this is everything that we know.
Tell me about Olof Palme. What's his background? What's his politics?
Olof Palme was our biggest statesman, Sweden's biggest statesman in the 20th century, maybe even longer. Despite the fact that he was from the upper class, he left his background and became the chairman of the Social Democratic Party. And he was extremely controversial inside Sweden and outside Sweden. So this was the beginning in the middle of the 80s. So we're coming up to the end of the Cold War. He took a very important role in it. He was always on the side of the poor and oppressed people around the world. So Olof Palme spent his whole political life fighting the apartheid regime of South Africa. At many times he was actually provoking and causing controversies with the superpowers, the USA and the Soviet Union.
He managed to provoke both of them.
He was against the Vietnam War, which provoked the US. They actually called their ambassador home twice from Stockholm because of Olof Palme. And when the Soviet Union invaded the Afghanistan, he spoke up fiercely against them.
So he had a lot of enemies.
He had enemies outside Sweden and also inside Sweden. So among his enemies, you would find even very important business leaders in Swedish industry. They were actually giving money secretly to people running campaigns against our prime minister. Sometimes we say that half of the people loved him, half of the people hated him.
And what was he like as a person?
Well, on the outside, in the domestic politics, he was arrogant, intelligent, and extremely strong in his techniques of debating. He's held some of the best speeches ever in Swedish and sometimes also in foreign languages.
Och därför är bombningarna ett illdåd. Och av det har vi många exempel i den moderna historien. Och de är i allmänhet förbundna med ett namn. Guernica, Oradour.
There's this speech when Olof Palme is speaking against the bombing of Vietnam. It's heartbreaking actually listening to it.
And as a man who was so loved and so loathed in Sweden, his death must have had an immediate and very differing reaction.
The moment when we learned that he had been murdered, that's one of those moments when Sweden stopped, when everybody knows what they did, and the whole country changed from that moment on.
All day they'd been standing silently behind the barricades just across the street from where it happened. People of Stockholm shocked and stunned that such an act of political violence should ever have taken place in this normally peaceful city of theirs. Police collecting their floral tributes and placing them on the exact spot where Olof Palme was gunned down.
Do you remember where you were when you heard?
I remember, and everybody remembers. I was working in a theater. I was running the lights on the late show on the Friday night, and just very close to when I was closing the curtains of that theater, that was the time when Olof Palme was shot in Stockholm. The next morning, my father called me to my small student apartment in Göteborg, where I was studying, and telling me this terrible news. My first reaction, I was just quiet. And my father was telling this in a very soft voice, which he never used otherwise, I would say. So I think we were started to mourn in that moment.
For the first few hours, amongst the grief was chaos. And at first, nobody was properly in charge of the police operation.
There were three possibilities, actually, of who would run the murder investigation. First, we had Tommy Lindström, also called Tommy Turbo, since he was caught driving 179 kilometers in his Saab Turbo.
He was the head of the National Criminal Investigation Department. His unit had experience dealing with violent crimes, so he might have seemed like the obvious candidate.
But this time he decided to stay at home instead, waiting for his sons to wake up so that they could greet him for his birthday. He only got to the office at 10:30. Then we had Sven-Åke Hjelmroth, who was head of the security police. But the security police were excluded because they were actually responsible for protecting the life of our prime minister, so nobody knew where their loyalty lay.
The third option, and the person that ended up taking charge, was the commissioner of the Stockholm County Police, Hans Holmér. When he heard about the murder, he was in bed with his girlfriend in a hotel 130 miles away. But he immediately got into his car and drove to Stockholm.
Hans Holmér was a cool guy. He was Sweden's answer to Clint Eastwood. He wore a black leather jacket and he talked with a dark voice.
Olof Palme blev skjuten I ryggen. Det finns ingenting som tyder på.
While he may have been seen as the Swedish Clint Eastwood, he was actually a lawyer by training and had never led a murder investigation before. The problem started from the outset.
So the police started to make mistakes immediately after the murder. The cordoned off area was much too small. They didn't find the bullets, which were found only a day or two later. They didn't question all the witnesses. They didn't contact witnesses that they had promised to call the day after. They didn't call for a national alarm. They didn't close the borders. They didn't close the airports. So the obvious things to do after a prime minister has been murdered.
And did Holmér, as time went on, start to focus in on any theories?
So very soon after the murder investigation started, Hans Holmér started to focus in on the Kurdish Liberation Organization, the PKK.
The PKK? That seems an unusual possibility.
Well, they were quite present in Sweden. Olof Palme's government had actually granted them asylum, and there were quite a few members present in Sweden. And they had been carrying out murders in Europe before.
Murders of politicians?
No, they had only been killing their own people of their own organization, so nothing similar. Hans Holmér is convinced that he's coming close to solving it. One reason was actually that his good friend Ebbe Carlsson, a spin doctor very close to Olof Palme also, had received information one day before the murder that the Kurds were actually planning to do a murder somewhere in Stockholm. And this proved to be a false, planted information.
And as time goes by, it seems clear that Holmér is sort of obsessed about a line of inquiry that doesn't seem to be coming to fruition. So what happened? Did he remain in place?
So Hans Holmér stayed in his position for the full first year of the investigation before he had to leave. But he continued the investigation in secret. They were actually smuggling eavesdropping equipment into Sweden illegally and were caught.
After Holmér left, the police worked for a while on the theory of a conspiracy involving multiple perpetrators. But then a new lead investigator was installed who focused instead on the theory of a lone killer. Within months, they found a suspect who fit the bill.
The drug abuser, Christer Pettersson. And Christer Pettersson was a person who had been close to the killing in time, and he was also someone who had killed before, very close to that scene also, and he was arrested and accused of having killed our prime minister.
Did they have any evidence?
By far the most important piece of evidence that they had against Christer Pettersson was the lineup and identification by the widow of our prime minister. Close to 3 years after the murder, in a video recording, she pointed out and said that's the person that I think killed my husband.
Based mainly on this identification parade and without forensic evidence, Pedersen was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. But shortly after, problems emerged with the evidence. It turned out that the police had influenced Lisbeth's decision. They told her that the man who killed her husband was a heavy drinker, so she picked out the person she thought looked most like that. Pedersen's conviction was quashed and he was released.
På slaget klockan 11 idag offentliggjordes den friande domen mot Christer Pettersson i Palmemålet.
And he was celebrating and all these journalists were surrounding him outside his apartment in on the outskirts of Stockholm when he brought a bottle of vodka and a bottle of Baileys, and that actually became the new trendy drink in the bars of Stockholm.
It became a cocktail.
Became a cocktail called the killer.
Wow. Can you still get a killer today?
Yeah, you can. I actually ordered one the other day, and it's still a possibility to have a killer in Stockholm.
Are they nice? Vodka and Baileys sounds a bit disgusting.
They're slightly better than a White Russian.
After Pedersen's release from prison in 1989, the investigation rolled on for decades through four different lead investigators. The Swedish press and public remained obsessed with the murder of Olof Palme. Nobody else was ever convicted, and the greatest mystery in Sweden remained unsolved. Meanwhile, in 2013, Jan was researching a book about Swedish murders. Not specifically the Olof Palme murder, but while rummaging through the archives, he came across a curious anonymous memo about a possible suspect in Palme's case.
And the paper wasn't signed, there was no date on it, and I asked the lady who had it, who wrote this, and she said something that turned my world over. She said, Stieg Larsson, the crime writer. And I was saying, what do you mean? Stieg Larsson, what has he got to do with the Palme murder? And she told me that he had spent a lot of time investigating the actual murder of our prime minister.
The world-famous author of The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, Stieg Larsson.
Yeah. So Stieg Larsson was a graphic designer working in the news agency of Sweden, TT. He dreamt of becoming a crime reporter, but he was stuck to his job as a graphic designer. So Stieg Larsson, from the first day, he was extremely interested in the murder case. He also got a lot of information from all the reporters at the news agency. So he was one of the persons that knew the most about the actual investigation very soon after. And he continued doing this for 18 years until the day he died. And when she told me that this paper was written by Stieg Larsson, she also told me, there may be more. And I knew I had to start looking for them.
How did you find them?
I started meeting with the friends of Stieg Larsson. I met his life partner, Eva Gabrielsson, and everybody told me, go look there, go look there. And in the end, I contacted the editor-in-chief of Expo, Daniel Poole.
Expo was a magazine founded by Larsson in the mid-1990s. It was a place where, on the side of his day job, he would carry out in-depth investigations into the far right in Sweden. Not long after Larsson's death, Daniel Poole took over as editor. And in doing so, took possession of all his unfinished work.
And he said that they may have some files, but they don't have the time really to look for it. And I managed to persuade him. And a couple of days later, we found ourselves outside the rented storage facility. I found memos, I found articles, I found reports, personal letters, top secret papers from the secret police, and I can read everything.
How did that feel?
I felt like a child in a candy store that can actually eat anything you want and as much as you want.
So what did you do? Were you allowed to take the papers away, or did you have to sit in the storage room and read them?
So the first day I wasn't allowed to leave the space, but I sat there and it almost felt like I was in paradise. I was sitting in this really simple building on the outskirts of Stockholm. The snow was blowing outside, but I just sat there and read for the whole day.
Eventually, Daniel Poole gave Jan proper access to the files. So he got to work trying to figure out what they meant.
First, I decided that I need to get order into his papers. So I started scanning everything. I OCR'd it so I could search inside digitally in his archive. And I started to get through the whole material. I started to get the picture of what Stieg Larsson thought had happened.
The theory sounds like it belongs less in the real world and more in one of Stieg Larsson's books. Here's how it goes. Palme was killed through an international conspiracy between two different groups.
The murder was ordered by the South African security services.
Yeah, the South Africans were actually angry at as Olof Palme working against their apartheid regime and also the weapon dealings that they were involved in.
The killer himself was a member of a Swedish right-wing extremist group who didn't like Palmer's politics.
The South Africans used the method that they've used several times in the same period of time, actually, where they pushed patsies, people with right-wing opinions, ahead of them to actually carry out the killing. And if they didn't manage to carry out the killing, they had backup of their own agents to actually help carry out the killing. And then the patsies were caught.
The murder was organised through a middleman, a Swedish national living in northern Cyprus.
A person called Bertil Wedin, who was working for the South African Secret Service, who was actually appointed to find the people that could help carrying out the killing in Sweden.
So, according to Larsen, the South Africans contacted their old friend Wedin, who then contacted the Swedish extremists, who then killed Palmer. They all deny it.
The South Africans are saying that they're innocent, that they have not done anything of this. The middleman says the same, but the Swedish police are at the moment looking into the South African trail, the middleman, and the right-wingers of Sweden.
Ian has taken the information from the files and continued with his own inquiries, including tracking down a walkie-talkie that was allegedly left by the scene of the murder. If it could be linked to the killing, that would suggest that multiple parties were involved. Hans Melander, the head of the Swedish police unit looking into the Palmer case, confirmed to us that officers are investigating this lead.
And I definitely think that this can be solved. It can take 1 or 2 years more before we have a solution.
I mean, it sounds the stuff of spy thrillers. Are you sure that this wasn't Stieg Larsson, the author, getting excited about the possibilities? I mean, the South African security services don't have a history of murdering prime ministers across the world.
Well, they do have a history of killing people around the world, actually. And they do have a history of trying to kill prime ministers. For instance, in Lesotho, they did these type of things.
There have been other theories that have gained a lot of traction in recent years too. And whether or not Stieg Larsson's theory is correct, what is fascinating to me is how obsessed he clearly was with it. These boxes and boxes of files, years worth of work. How obsessed Hans Holmer became, smuggling in illegal eavesdropping equipment. How obsessed so many others have become. Over 130 people have falsely confessed to the killing.
Oh, yes, sir.
There are books and films. There's a podcast just about the killing, which has over 100 episodes.
Sveriges statsminister Olof Palme är död.
90,000.
Ta emot på Sveavägen.
Hörde de säga att det är Palme som är skjuten?
There is a term, Palmer virus, which means being taken over with this obsession. Do you think you have it?
Yeah, it's definitely something, an obsession that many people have caught in Sweden. It comes and goes in waves, and I actually think we're on a big wave right now. I definitely caught it, but you can have it for 10 years and then you're still okay. But if you go for 20, then you turn crazy.
How long have you had it?
I've had it for 9.
That's why you're drinking the killers.
Yeah, exactly.
You need it. Why do you think that this case has become such a pervasive issue for Sweden? It was clearly a horrible crime, but it happened more than 30 years ago. Why is it that people are unable to let go?
It's the ultimate mystery. It's something where you got all this information and you think that it must be somewhere in there. And if you just put the pieces together right, you will be the one who solves the mystery. The killing of our prime minister is actually the worst crime against democracy ever in Sweden. And it's, of course, extremely important to solve it. And that's also one of the reasons why so many people are trying and continuing to try.
Jan, I hope you recover from your Palmer virus. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jan Stockglasser, whose book, The Man Who Played with Fire, is out now. If you're intrigued by the Palmer case, then I'd really recommend The Guardian long read, Who Killed the Prime Minister, by Imogen West-Knights. You can find it on the website. Coming up, marriage equality history is made in Northern Ireland. Now, today is Valentine's Day, and while the thought of it might make you cringe, we've got something to celebrate, as this week saw the first same-sex marriage take place in Northern Ireland after that historic vote in Westminster. On Tuesday, Robin Peoples from Belfast and Sharni Edwards from Brighton tied the knot in County Antrim, and we caught up with a couple just before the big day.
Sharni means the absolute world to me. From the day I met her, I knew that's who I was going to spend my life with. There's just no words to describe the love I have for her.
She's not only my partner, she's my best friend, and I just feel quite humbled and privileged that I'm able to marry my best friend now. We actually met in a nightclub called Kremlin, a gay nightclub here in Belfast, and ever since that night, we were inseparable.
We're a lot more different in certain aspects than we are similar, where Sharni would be absolutely obsessed with football. I tolerate it, but we compromise, and I think that's how we work. Being gay in Northern Ireland is hard. When we couldn't get the right to get married, it sort of gave them ground to discriminate, because if they weren't giving us the rights to be equal, people aren't seeing you as equal, they are seeing you beneath them. And it's just not right at all.
I didn't know that it wasn't legalised in Northern Ireland until I actually met Robin and she opened my eyes and made me aware. And I just could not comprehend it. I couldn't comprehend how far behind Northern Ireland was compared to the rest of the UK. The fact that people are still dictating how people should live their lives is just insane, especially in the 21st century.
The politicians were fighting against it, saying, no, we're religious and it should be a man and a woman. To see them and telling us how we should live our lives absolutely is disgusting.
Marriage is important because it makes you feel like you're equal to everyone. The majority of the world can get married, so why can't gay couples get married? There is no excuse. We're all human beings. We should all be treated exactly the same. It's time that we're all equal.
It's the commitment side. You know, I want to be able to commit to the woman I love and get married to her. Not everyone wants to get married, and that's absolutely grand, whether you're straight or gay or lesbian, but just to have that right.
The fact that this bill has now been passed is just amazing, and I feel very humbled myself to be able to celebrate it with everyone from Northern Ireland.
The fight hasn't ended. We still need to keep going. Say I had a civil partnership with Sharni. Just like any other marriage, you would have to get dissolved in some way. But if there's no grounds, if you're still in love with that person, they haven't cheated, they haven't been abusive, then you've no grounds to get that ended, to then get married. So a lot of people are in the position where they have had their civil partnership and now they want to get married to be equal like everyone, but they find themselves in a position where they can't. That needs to be still fought for, and we will keep fighting until that day.
That was Robin Peoples and Sharni Edwards, who are now in Cyprus on their honeymoon. I hope they have a wonderful time. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a cracking weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.